This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Books Podcast. I'm Claire Armistead.
I'm Richard Lee.
And I'm Sian Kane.
It's that time of year when our attentions are nudged sharply towards the world stage by the announcement of the Man Booker International Prize shortlist. This year, the chat has all been about how 5 of the 6 authors and all 6 of the translators are women. Is this a happy coincidence or a healthy sign that publishers are finally encouraging women's voices to flourish? Author of the 100 Best Novels in Translation, Boyd Tonkin, joins us to discuss it. But first, after last week's discussion of regional differences, this week we welcome another of Ireland's rising stars, Nicole Flattery. Flattery has been steadily building a reputation as a deft observer of modern life with a series of short stories, winning the White Review Short Story Prize in 2017 with Track, a story of a young Irish woman adrift in New York City. Last year, she landed that holy grail of literary fiction, a 6-figure 2-book deal, woo-woo, the first instalment of which, Show Them a Good Time, is just out. So, Richard, why did you want to bring Nicole into the studio?
Well, she's just a really strong voice. I mean, it's somebody I've been following since seeing her stories appear in Stinging Fly, where the Hump was her first, I think, in 2015. The Dublin Review, a Sweet Talk appeared there. There's 2 stories from the collection that appeared in 2016.
So this is a short story collection. Are we expecting 2 short story collections, or might there be a short story collection and a novel?
She signed a deal for this collection of short stories and then a novel, which she's still in the middle of.
You always sort of rather wonder whether the publishers aren't saying, oh, we'll get over with the short stories and then we'll have the novel.
I think it's a vote of confidence to start with a collection of short stories these days, because, I mean, short stories are famously difficult to sell. So the idea that they can introduce her with this collection, I think, is very much kind of a thumbs up.
You mentioned there the 2 Dublin periodicals and The Stinging Fly particularly, which Sally Rooney edited.
Which she edits now.
She's on sabbatical, I think, at the moment, but she is technically the editor. It's becoming the engine house of this new wave of Irish fiction, isn't it?
Yes, yeah, so it's an extraordinary publication. They've got a really good nose for things. And I think they're actually bringing out her collection in Ireland. They're publishing it as part of their book division as well.
So what kind of thing is Nicole Flattery doing?
Well, there's a similar kind of wit and freshness to somebody like Sally Rooney, really. I mean, most of the stories in this collection are about young women who are looking for some sort of role in life. They're often adrift or slightly looking for something to do, or kind of slightly to the side of something that they might be in the middle of. There's a lot of dysfunctional relationships. There's trauma and there's abuse in the background. But there's always a dose of dry humour. I mean, she's got this terrific wry voice, which undercuts these rather difficult stories with a dose of a laugh. And so when she joined me in the studio, she began by reading from the opening of the first story in the book, Show Them a Good Time.
The schemes were for people with plenty of time or people not totally unfamiliar with being treated like shit. I was intimate with both situations. Management interviewed me. Bizarre questions through an inch of plexiglass. How long and hours have you been unemployed? Did you misspend your youth throwing stones at passing cars? This can be a tangential process, management explained, and I said sorry. Only peasants apologise, management stated and returned to obscure markings. The interview was an all-nighter, designed to break my spirit and ensure I pledged organisation and responsibility for the rest of my days. I emerged from it not completely sure of anything except my own name and my age, which I knew was somewhere in my late 20s. In the morning, I was taken to the bathroom to be measured for a uniform. The toilet stall had the dark, depthless feel of a place where a body may have lain undiscovered for days. The shirt gave me breasts. The regulation boots gave me legs. All those parts I'd worked so hard to forget were now reunited under surprising polyester circumstances. When I was dressed, management offered me a manic thumbs up. Management was round, almost perfectly so, and given to spontaneous bursts of laughter. She looked at me in my white and empty face and asked, "Isn't it great to be able to give yourself a giggle?" I saw in that gesture her former life as a farmhand, the crazy ease which she sent animals off to be slaughtered. Management explained the procedure again. Our function was to be near the till, maintain the appearance of the garage, and most importantly, believe. Management left the room as I screened the demonstration video. In it, three participants with the sexless good looks of catalogue models spoke of the joy of being back at work. Whenever they did something spontaneous or considered outside their remit, a large X popped up on screen. As I watched, I felt giddy and ashamed, as if I were witnessing a particular vicious type of pornography. Management suggested if I ever felt like I didn't believe, I should go for a short, furious walk, maybe up and down the motorway path, and stay away from my colleagues, as my attitudes and sulky face could be hazardous. She said I seemed like a nice person, and if we had customers, they'd probably like me. I had a personality that was best suited to short interactions. "Should I get a business card made?" I asked. "It's something to consider," management said, and she repeated her manic thumbs up.
So when did you start putting these stories together? Did it take a little while, or did they all come of a piece?
The first story I published is in this book, so it's called Hump, and it's the first story I ever published, and it was in a Stinging Fly issue. I think it was 2015. It was a very good issue, a little known...
You say so yourself.
Yeah, I was in it. A little known poet called Sally Rooney. Yeah. She had poems in there. Yeah, and then I just kind of was working from then on. I wrote that story, and that was published in The Stinging Fly. Then I had a couple in the Dublin Review and the White Review. And once there was a number published, Declan Mead, who is the editor of The Stinging Fly, offered to help me work towards a collection. So I had that specific goal. I was working towards finishing a collection.
Because they're all very much of a piece in a way.
Yeah, they did.
Part of the same gesture.
Yeah, I felt that. Someone said that to me. They were like, it could be the same character at different points in her life. And I wasn't thinking about that when I was writing it, but it worked that way.
There's a lot of acting going on. There's a whole play even.
Yeah. There is a lot of acting.
are these women having trouble finding a meaningful role?
Yes, I think that's very true. I think, yeah, and that reflected my own life. I wrote them in my 20s, and I think it's certainly a confused period, and these stories reflect that confusion, you know. I studied theatre myself, so I guess I gravitate towards...
It's a bit of that in the background.
Yeah, I gravitate towards writing about it and thinking about it, and it's how I learned to write. I started writing plays, so it's still there in some kind of way, you know.
And so these women are kind of trying on different parts, aren't they?
Yeah, there's definitely that runs throughout the whole thing. I think even clothes are referred to as costumes in one part, and show them a good time. They wear these work costumes and things. And yeah, I guess it's also a sign that I've had these jobs, certainly when I was in my early 20s, where nothing felt real. Everything kind of felt absurd. You'd be sitting there in these clothes that you just bought, and I feel like this isn't real. I'm in a play about work. This isn't work.
The women, they're not very productive either, are they?
They're not very
busy. They're kind of shuffling through these awful
their
jobs.
Their internal lives are productive. There's a lot happening there. But they're not really. They're not very productive, I guess. Yeah, I guess I guess
there's a certain kind of passivity.
Yeah.
I mean, what's the kind of fascination there? Basically, that things are happening to them, that they're going through these...
Yeah, they're kind of passive. I think that like...
And
that
as you say,
be...
it's all happening on the inside.
Yeah, definitely. That they're just they don't have much control over their own lives, which I guess I also felt that a lot in my own life when I was certainly struggling with things.
That's just a reflection of how it feels at that stage.
Yeah, but I feel like lots of young women would feel that way. And then the way they try and take control is within their own kind of responses, or just becoming quite silent and stepping back. Yeah.
I mean, there's also a certain amount of kind of sexual dysfunction as well. There's a certain amount of porn as well. And there's a spell in the city earning ugly money in Show Them a Good Time. There's Lucy sending out pictures to men online in Abortion, a Love Story. Her finger in her mouth, her breasts on show and her legs wide open. Is that kind of pornographic material just part of life in the 21st century?
I think so. I feel like I'm not wrong in saying that that's so. I might listen back and be like, oh, I wish I hadn't said that. No, I think so. I feel like it's just so ingrained in our culture that it's not even strange for me to approach it.
It's just part of furniture.
Yeah, exactly. Furniture would be definitely would relate and show them a good time. There's that link between. But I feel like I'm so accepting of it, you know. Maybe it's because I've grown up with it, but yeah.
It's just because of our kind of smartphone culture, always being connected to something that is only a step away from something.
Yeah, and then it also, you know, was because of the unreality of the lives of these characters, it makes like sex seem like an unreal thing, and I feel like the characters definitely feel that way. They're like one step away from their like own sexual lives, you know. They're almost like they're watching it, you know.
Yes, like it's almost like it's done almost to appear good for something else somewhere else.
Yeah, definitely.
But there's a certain amount of, you know, there's a certain amount of damage there, abusive. There's abusive relationships as well. Then there's even kind of there's a glint of sexualized violence as well. I mean, we were talking on an earlier edition of the Books podcast about sexual violence in recent fiction from writers like Kristen Rupinian and Leila Slimani. I mean, are these shock tactics or is it just a new sort of courage to talk about things that have been going on all the while?
I don't think it's shock tactics in the sense that the book that I would consider is like sexually, most sexually explicit is Bad Behavior by Mary Gaitskill, and that came out late 80s, early 90s. So I feel like it was always there, but maybe women or female writers have more kind of confidence to talk about it now or write about it in a way. I certainly, like when I write about these things, I don't feel like I'm being shocking. I feel like I'm approaching something that's already in my life, you know, or it's something that's all like I'm already surrounded by. So the only thing you can do is respond.
But I mean, and that's a certain about that's a question of the Me Too movement and the way that even if it's always been there, there's a question in which it's now it's more possible to talk about it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And those power dynamics maybe are like a little bit like more open, you know, than they were before, where it felt like everything was kind of underneath the surface. Then this conversation started happening that like definitely opened up probably new things in fiction, like Catperson. Like suddenly everyone was talking about this. Everyone was talking about a short story, which is wild in itself.
I mean, do you think there's a kind of responsibility now that there's this openness, as the lid has been, as it were, taken off it? There's a new possibility. Do you think there's a responsibility to deal with that kind of material?
I think so. Like to ignore it would be like certainly a little wrong or, I definitely think that we're right to write about young women's and women's like sexual lives in a way that's confident and assertive, and it's a good thing that's happening.
It's just a kind of unavoidable thing in the moment where we're at.
Yeah.
I mean, that's wondering about the voice as well. I mean, as you were saying earlier, they all kind of feel of a piece in some sense. Where did this flat, ironic voice come from?
I think it's my own voice. a little bit. They do. They all kind of quite do have similar voices. And I feel that like that's like, you know, the gap between what they're presenting, particularly in like something like Track with a girl at Stay in the Comedian, the person she's presenting to him and like what her actual internal voice is telling her is like huge. And like that's like a very interesting space for me, you know, to kind of explore. You know, she's sitting there with him and all his friends, and you know, it's quite obviously she hates all of them, but she can't like find a way to express that in her own life. And she has like a certain probably value system and morals, but they're getting lost and muddled. And I think that's very, you know, true. Like when you're trying to make your way in the world, you suddenly are put in these situations where you don't know who you are. You're in a new place, a new city, and you feel this complete detachment. And I think I like exploring that.
And she responds to it by flattening things out, not saying it.
Yeah.
And also with humour. I mean, do you think humour is an important part of it?
Yeah, I think so. I think humour gives you a kind of strength without really like being too like girl bossy. Like I don't want to be like, it's a way of, a certain kind of like a little bit of ironic detachment. It can be a way of finding kind of strength and power, you know.
And also, if you have these women who have these difficult lives or these lives where they're not quite sure where they fit in, is it a way of bringing the reader along with that as well?
Yes, definitely. Yeah, I was talking about this recently. I feel that I think I read an interview with Phoebe Waller-Bridge, and I enjoy that show. And she was talking about how, like, if you make a joke early, I think Kevin Barry said something like this, you already have the reader or the viewer, and then you can go somewhere else. And I think if you can make them laugh, then you've got them at a place. Not that it's a device, because, like, I like humour and I like funny books, and I think they should exist just because they are funny. But I think you can then go to a darker place if you've caught them off guard a little bit.
You've done that already.
Yeah.
I mean, is that a kind of, that is Fleabag? Is that
essentially. Yeah.
Is that a kind of, is that...
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
A third of students are less than happy about their university choice, new research by EY has revealed. The findings suggest that a digital rethink is essential to meet the expectations of students and staff. Universities can address this by putting the needs of the people they serve at the heart of their digital strategies. Learn more about the future of human-centered higher education at theguardian.com/transforminghighereducation. This message was paid for by EY.
The space in which you're working with you.
I feel like I don't think I'm as good. But I know what she's trying to do, and I think she does it like incredibly well, you know, that kind of darkness that, like, just say in Hump, where, you know, there's been a death, but she kind of moves away from the grief, but yet the grief is like very, very like present.
That hands out sandwiches.
Yeah.
I also want to ask a little bit about the endings, mm-hmm. the balance, particularly in a short story, yeah. that's so crucial between mm-hmm. a sense of arrival and the yeah. ability to open out into some sort of transcendence. So yeah. The ending something that come naturally out of what's come before, or is it something you need to work at?
It's interesting. I think that I redraft a lot. So I do a lot of drafts, and then kind of when I'm looking over things and like looking at things in a new kind of way, I might find the ending already in the story. For I felt that, like, in Track, that the ending was there, you know, that she kind of becomes this, I don't want to give the ending away, but I
no felt spoilers.
No. The ending, when you read the book, you'll understand. No, and then the Show Them a Good Time as well, I felt the ending was like already in the material. The Abortion and Love Story took a little longer because I was really putting off writing the play, and then...
Do you realise the whole play had to be in it?
Yeah, because someone told me. They were like, just do it. I know you really don't want to, but you have to, because that is the natural conclusion. I think with the short story, a natural conclusion comes when you've taken it as far as it can go, and that's the end, you know?
That's the moment.
Yeah. Because yeah. you can tinker with them for so long. Like, you can be like arranging sentences, and I've had times when I've really... been working on a story for like a year, and you kind of have to at some point be like, I'm going to send this out, or I'm going to ask someone to read it, or else you're very precious.
is there a certain kind of amount of that same job goes on when you're putting a collection together to yeah. get the stories to work one off another?
Yeah, actually, yeah, it's interesting putting the collection together. I hadn't thought about how you put a collection together. Like, I read a lot of story collections, but I don't always read them in order. And I would like maybe...
Dart in and out.
I did, yeah. I pick them up and I put them down. And then, like, I read the longest first or the shortest first or whatever. And I never really thought about the actual arrangement of the stories. But now I've done it, I will dutifully read a collection in order all the time out of respect, because it actually took me a while to do this.
To respect all that work.
Yeah. Because one story is quite a bit longer, so we have to arrange the others around it. And so...
Is there something going on in Ireland right now? Do you feel part of a kind of wave, a movement?
Yeah, definitely. A movement. I like that. because incredibly amazing time for Irish writing. But I feel like I've been saying that for like, or I've been hearing that for like 5 or 10 years. It's like, how long do we have?
Next wave is coming.
Yeah, I know.
Why is that? Where's that come from?
I don't. It's kind of hard to pinpoint precisely what it is. I feel that like we have like a very good literary magazine community. So like there's The Stinging Fly and the Dublin Review and Gorse and Winter Papers. And that is very encouraging. Like, I feel like when I was in my 20s and things, that like, and I get a story published, you know, that can really give you the confidence to keep going. And then you meet other writers and that support, you find readers. So I feel like that's like a good reason. And then maybe like... weather reasons, it rains a lot, we can't go outside. A couple of reasons like that.
But. And it's one thing whereby the writers that you meet, the writers that you read, the writers you get to know them and start in some sense yeah. on the same project.
Yeah. And it's kind of have a conversation. It's nice, it's good to have people you can ask read your work if you feel stuck, or like even just to chat to about books and things, and that's you know, useful. You know, you don't want to be shut off. Although people have this like romantic image of writers like being
in
shut off. Yeah, but I don't think that's good.
So what's coming next? Do you feel a little bit under pressure after signing a massive 6-figure book deal?
I do. I do feel under pressure. I'm working on a novel, and it's a very different thing from a story collection. You kind of have to unlearn everything you learned writing stories. Like writing a story, you're like focusing on the sentence, hinting at things, you know, like all the little techniques I just feel that are no longer useful for getting a first draft of a novel done. So it's kind of...
You just get it out.
Yeah, you just have to write it, which is like such a strange concept to me. Whereas I'm used to like changing paragraphs, you know, like changing a paragraph, I'm like, that's my day's work. But this is a whole different thing. It is a new challenge. I'm looking forward to it.
Is it set in the same world?
No, it's set in the factory, the Andy Warhol's factory. And it's two girls who are typists in the factory. And it's kind of about their work. I'm quite interested in, you know, these characters. And I think that's reflected in this book, like who are on the periphery, you know, like standing beside the famous person, not necessarily the famous person. So these two girls typed up a novel Andy Warhol kind of recorded called A Novel. And it's just about their lives.
And there's still the same fascination with art. What do you think art does for fiction?
I feel like I'm not hugely influenced by other writers, but I'm like influenced a lot by like films and like theatre and things like that. So I feel like all the forms.
And television.
And TV, yeah, exactly. Although, no, I can't. But I guess, yeah, all these different kind of forms coming into play. And it's interesting, like reading a lot about Andy Warhol. I've been reading a lot about him. And like, I just kind of have to stop reading about him because you could just spend your whole life. Like, there's so much material. It's ridiculous, you know. But that's to...
So you need to get on and write it.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, yeah. I contacted a biographer of his. Someone put me in touch with him. And she messaged me back and was like, my advice to you is what Andy always said. Just make it up. And I was like, that's fantastic. That's like what I needed, permission.
Nicole Flattery there talking to Richard.
Andy Warhol, eh? It'd be very interesting to see how such a contemporary voice deals with a period setting like that.
Yeah, it just goes to show you can make it up, as Andy would assure us all. After the break, we'll be travelling continents discussing the exciting new Man Booker International shortlist.
The Voice Lab from The Guardian.
Hey, do you ever want a quick catch-up on the news headlines first thing in the morning while you're making breakfast or getting dressed? Well, if you have a Google Assistant or Google Home, we can help with that. The Guardian Briefing is an experiment from the Voice Lab, which in under 2 minutes brings you up to speed with what you need to know about the day's top stories. We'll make sure you don't miss a thing. To listen at any time, just say, "Hey Google, speak to the Guardian Briefing."
We said we'd be talking the Man Booker International shortlist, but that's really just an excuse to get our teeth into some literature in translation. I've been thinking quite a lot about it over the last few weeks for a huge investigation into the creative relationships between writers and their translators. And one of the oracles I consulted to put it all in context joins me and Sian now in the studio. He's Boyd Tonkin, and his book, The 100 Best Novels in Translation, is just out in paperback. But first of all, let's go through the Man Booker shortlist.
Yes. So we have Celestial Bodies by Jotka Al-Harthy. She's from Oman and translated from Arabic by Marilyn Booth. The Years by Annie Ernaux, a French author, and translated by Alison Strayer. The Pine Islands by Marion Poschmann from Germany, translated by Jen Kalesia. Drive Your Plough Over the Bones of the Dead by Olga Tokarczuk from Poland and translated by Antonia Lloyd-Jones. The Shape of the Ruins by Juan Gabriel Vasquez from Colombia is translated from Spanish by Anne McLean. And The Remainder by Alia Trabuco Zaran, as she's from Chile and Italy, and it's translated from Spanish by Sophie Hughes.
Well, that put you through your paces, your translation paces.
My excellent pronunciation. I'm really sorry if I've offended anyone listening.
Boyd, you're always the advanced telegraph, really, aren't you, when it comes to novels in translation? How many of these are you familiar with?
I'm familiar with 4 of them, and I'm doing my best to catch up with the other two.
So you have for a long time been a fan of Juan Gabriel Vasquez, haven't you?
I have, yes. He's one of the remarkable generation of Colombian writers who are not so much the sons and daughters of the boom generation. They are, if you like, the grandchildren of that great cohort of Latin American writers, Fuentes and Marquez and so forth.
They're called boom generation. That's the sort of name that's given for them in Latin America.
Yes. And as you might expect, whenever there's a kind of global cultural phenomenon of the type that you had with Marquez and his peers, there is a reaction, not against them, but you might say beyond them. And so if you read a novel, say, by Juan Gabriel Vázquez, expecting levitating opera houses and clouds of butterflies and all the normal cliches of so-called magical realism, you will be either delighted or disappointed because it's completely different.
It's an investigation of a historical political crime, basically.
I have to say it's a particularly relevant novel for people here to be reading now, because it's about how political division, how political tribalism, the separation of a country into warring camps, affects the long-term future of that place and, to some extent, poisons the entire society.
Well, the next one I'm going to bring up is Drive Your Plough Over the Bones of the Dead, which is partly because Sian is reading it at this moment. Yeah. I've been hooting on about Olga for about 2 years.
Yeah.
You finally got around
to
it.
Finally converted.
And you're enjoying it.
Yeah, really, really, very much. And it's not what I was expecting at all. And perhaps that's my own ideas about the kinds of books that get nominated for literary prizes like this one. But I wasn't really expecting a whodunit. You told me it was going to be a whodunit. And I was like, yeah, but it won't be. And then I really, and it's like, it's so much fun. But of course, then there's this much sort of wider context in this novel of Poland and its politics and feminism and vegetarianism, and it's quite dark at the same time as being quite fun. But I really like Janina, the main narrator.
We were discussing how old she was, and I have a horrible sort of feeling she's probably about the same age as me. Although she seems older.
I was sort of thinking, I've been imagining like Miss Marple but with dreads, like Olga, because Olga's got this very cool head of dreads, and I'm just sort of thinking like a hippie Miss Marple. But yeah, she's such a cool narrator. I really like her.
What did you think of it, Boyd? You've reviewed it.
I absolutely loved it. And I should say that the great thing about the Man Book International is that it rewards the author and the translator equally. And in this case, Olga has the most wonderful partner, if you like, in the shape of Antoni Lloyd-Jones, who's a brilliant translator from Polish, who really finds the right voice for this incredible maverick heroine. And of course, the heroine, Janina, she is steeped in English romantic literature. The actual title is a line from Blake. So if you're translating from the Polish, you also have to find a way of incorporating the fact that the original contains references to English as well. So all of these layers of complexity make the task of a translator a bit like playing four-dimensional chess blindfold.
Antonia was saying, telling me about how, it does involve translating a Blake poem.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. From English into English via Polish. And what, very sweetly, you mentioned Antonia particularly, Jennifer Croft, Olga's other translator, won with her last year for Flights, won this prize. And Antonia was saying, I was asking Antonia if she wasn't a little bit jealous when they went up to win, since Antonia is the longer standing translator. And she said, no, they're sort of like Team Tkaczyk and they're very good friends. And she said, and in fact, it was Jennifer who persuaded her that it was possible to do her own version of a Blake poem, which to her as an English writer in that tradition, thought it was preposterously presumptuous to do a translation of Blake from English into English. So let's move on to another of the veterans, because Tkaczyk, although she's not been known very long in this country, she's a very distinguished best-selling novelist with a huge backlist waiting to be translated. And another of those is Annie Ernaux with The Years. Tell us a little bit about that. I haven't read it, I have to say.
Yeah, well, I'm very glad to see that on the list, partly because Annie Ernaux is the most extraordinary writer and I think very much underappreciated outside France, someone who's been telling stories of everyday life in France in a highly original, distinctive style for really quite a long time now, and has never really flourished in the English language translation scene, which is, alas, is all too common. And this novel, with its title that obviously for an English language reader inevitably brings to mind Virginia Woolf, has aroused a bit of debate about the question of where the borders of fiction and non-fiction lie, because it is a kind of collective voicing of the experience of a generation growing up from the 50s and 60s right through to the present day. It has a kind of almost like a sort of collective narrator, really. So it becomes a way of transmuting the lives of many, many people into a single story. So it's very bold, very original on various fronts, one of which is the way that it turns the material of recent history into a single narrative. So the question arises, is this something that counts as a novel? Is it more like a kind of creative documentary? And for me, I think ever since the days of Don Quixote, the novel has flourished by pressing against the boundaries of what it's supposed to be. And I don't see any sign of that slackening. And I think Annie Ernaux is simply in a very long and honourable tradition of people who are really extending those frontiers of what we think of as fiction.
So, Sean, you thought that this might have a good chance purely on the basis that it is innovative, formally challenging and interesting.
Well, I wrote the news story last week about the shortlist, and so went and met with the judges to get an idea of what their decision-making process was like, and they were very keen to say how excited they were that this book was setting a precedent. And I think particularly with novels in translation, with European fiction, we're seeing quite a lot of these novels that are pushing into what is called autofiction, that it is a sort of strange blend of memoir and novel. And I think they're quite taken with the idea that this is going to set a exciting new precedent for the prize going forward. So I do wonder whether it might actually, maybe they've given away their thinking a bit when they were talking to me about
it. They can always sort of produce red herrings, can't they?
Totally.
A red herring. We love a red
surprise
herring.
Surprise, Olga's won again.
So those are the three best known people. And then there are a couple of very unknown, partly because, for example, when did we last ever indeed have a novel from Oman in English?
Well, Celestial Bodies. I was reading it this morning, actually. I'm sort of about halfway through it. And it is really interesting because it has this tumbling flow to it that does actually remind you of a sort of Arabic myth, like 1001 Nights, where there's no punctuation, and in terms of like in the dialogue, there's no punctuation, so you're just sort of falling in and out of voices, and you've got a huge cast of characters because it's all sort of built around this one family in Oman, but over three generations. And it's really interesting because I think it's most focused on the middle generation of this family, and you see the adults in the family looking back to their parents who were sort of very firmly, you know, arranged marriages, talk about having slaves in the family, that sort of thing, and then their children who are sort of rich and play video games and go on holidays to Dubai. And it's a really, really interesting portrait of a country that is very old but has modernized very quickly. And so I have to say that perhaps I'm finding some of it a bit flowery, some of the writing, but it is a really interesting family. And it's certainly very relatable to anyone that's got a big family. You'll probably enjoy some of the drama between different family members.
So interestingly, Burhan Somnez, who is a Kurdish-Turkish novelist, won the EBRD Prize, which is a new prize by the European Bank of Reconstruction and Development, last year, with a story which is also based on the 1001 Nights. And I just think it's really interesting to look at the way in which these writers coming in from other cultures bring with them a different model of what the the foundations of the novel are. We might look back to Don Quixote, as you said, Boyd, but they look back to 1001 Nights in these two instances.
And bear in mind, of course, that the idea that there is some rigid distinction between what is European and what is non-European in fiction is itself a bit of a narrow myth. Look at Don Quixote itself, where there's this running joke that Cervantes has that Don Quixote is a translation from the Arabic. So you could say that at the very foundation, at the fountainhead of what we think of as the European tradition in the novel, there is this acknowledgement that it comes from further away.
That is so interesting, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Okay, we need to move on to The Pine Islands, which is a German novel that, again, I'm horrified and afraid to say I don't know.
No, I can say I know it. it's a funny little book. It's really funny but dark, and it's got a sort of absurd and detached tone to it. So basically, we start with this academic who wakes up and has had a dream that his wife has been cheating on him, and then confronts her about this dream he's had, and then they have a fight, and within the first page he's gotten on a plane and he's gone to Japan. He's just upped and left and hasn't told her where he's going. But it's kind of one of those novels that asks you, okay, just don't expect any of these characters to act the way that you would act in this situation, and just sort of go with it. And it's actually a lot of fun. I wasn't expecting how fun it is.
Well, you have to leave it on my desk when you finish with it. And then the final one is The Remainder from Chile and Italy. That's interesting. Tell us, how did that happen?
Well, The Remainder, it's a debut, actually, and rather excitingly, I don't really know, because I haven't read the Juan Gabriel Vasquez, but there is this common thread, I think, about the shadow of the past and how it can hang over people. And with this book, it's basically three 20-somethings who have decided, well, they're sort of trying to escape Chile's sort of military dictatorship, the past of it. And there's this journey that they decide to go on to go locate a corpse. And it sounds dark, and it is dark, but it's, again, there is an interesting narrative thread through it. And particularly if you read the opening paragraph, which is actually one sentence, there is, I thought, a real flair to the how it's been translated, in that it's quite dizzying. It makes you want to read it all in one breath, but it's a very effective way of laying out a sort of political situation that I'm not familiar with at all.
And this is, as going back to your line about Juan Boyd, this is what Latin American writers are doing all the time at the moment, isn't it? This terrible past of the last 50 years or so.
Absolutely. If you look at across the continent, in Colombia, in Chile, in Argentina, to some extent in Brazil, in Peru, in so many places, there is the sense of a nightmare that hasn't yet been fully digested. And fiction is one of those places where the ghosts can be confronted and hopefully banished. And therefore, the responsibility of writers in societies like this is, I think, something that is taken very, very seriously. And we talk about the boom. There's been another kind of boom recently, which is you could call it the fictional archaeology of memory, and in particular using fiction as a way at least of understanding the wounds of a society, if not of actually healing them.
You could sort of call the fiction of Latin America at the moment, drive your plough over the bones of the dead, couldn't you? Parche,
absolutely.
Olga.
Well done. Perfectly. Yes.
Now I want to move to your book, Boyd, to move away from what's happening now. Yeah. Both Annie Ernaux, I think, was first published in the late mid-1990s, yes. So she could have had a place at the end of your book. Vasquez, he actually did start writing in 1997, but wasn't translated until 2004, yeah. I think.
Yes,
Late. I'm sure he would have been in there.
That my cut-off point was actually the year 2000.
Yeah, why did you make that cut-off?
Partly it was because I wanted to avoid having to pass judgment on very, very contemporary literature, which is always difficult, I think. And you could say it's a bit arbitrary, of course it is. And if, for instance, I had extended the time frame just a couple of years further, I can think of some great novels I might have included, but you have to stop somewhere.
Well, it also gives you a chance for a second volume, doesn't it?
it certainly does. And I've been thinking precisely about this. So what are the most memorable, the most enduring novels to have been published, for instance, in translation between the millennium and now? After all, we are now shockingly a fifth into the next century.
Yeah. You were a judge on the first of the Man Booker International Prizes that were refashioned as
That's
a prize
right,
for
in
novel.
2016.
And you gave it to Han Kang, the vegetarian. Yes. Now, would you say that would make your next book as one of the 100?
I think it would be an incredibly strong contender, because that was one of the experiences judging a prize where you come across the almost like a comet that streaks in from a distant galaxy. Of course, it's our fault that Korean literature was so distant for us, and so little came to us before Deborah Smith delivered this wonderful translation of Han Kang. And it has opened up a completely new terrain. And there is masses of what sounds completely fascinating Korean literature just waiting to be translated and discovered. Obviously, it's a bit silly. It's been discovered by Koreans long ago. But a lot of it does exist
in terribly bad academic translations. That's one of my bugbears. I've tried to read it a few years back. Yeah. And so Deborah's really did deliver us, opened the magic cupboard.
Yeah. That was an exemplary tale, because she translated it beautifully. And then, of course, the academic translators pile in and accuse her of committing various errors. And there is a really deep question here about what is an error in a translation. If a literary version which is faithful to the underlying structure, spirit and organization of a book commits what are deemed to be faults according to a much narrower set of criteria, how much does that matter? Obviously, the ideal is something that succeeds on every possible front, but that ideal is not always going to be achieved. And from my point of view, it is the literary translation that creates a parallel work of art, which is the faithful version.
Thanks, Boyd. The 100 Best Novels in Translation is out soon in paperback from Galileo Publishers. Nicole Flattery's Show Them a Good Time is published by Bloomsbury. Next week, we'll be celebrating Shakespeare's birthday with the Oxford professor Emma Smith. Plus, we'll be talking to the novelist Tash Orr about his new portrait of the rapid change sweeping across Southeast Asia.
And as always, do contact us on Twitter @GuardianBooks or by leaving a comment on the podcast page. And do subscribe and review us wherever you get your podcasts.
But for now, from me, Claire Armistead.
Me, Sian Kane.
Me, Richard Lee.
And our producer, Susanna Trezillian. Goodbye, and thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.
A third of students are less than happy about their university choice, new research by EY has revealed. The findings suggest that a digital rethink is essential to meet the expectations of students and staff. Universities can address this by putting the needs of the people they serve at the heart of their digital strategies. Learn more about the future of human-centered higher education at theguardian.com/transforminghighereducation. This message was paid for by EY.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.